From Nevada to Illinois, Wyoming to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the integrity of the 2020 presidential election has been called into question as many Americans suspect massive fraud. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation is here to talk about what changes need to be made to make the system more secure. All eyes are on the Peach State as a bus tour through Georgia is underway to rally Republican turnout for those two U.S. Senate runoff races. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. With COVID-19 cases stressing the healthcare system, telemedicine can help ease the burden. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Rob Johnson from the Institute for Justice about efforts to make that possible. And on this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the heart of the Constitution is on the ballot in the Georgia runoff elections. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The legal wrangling over the outcome of the 2020 presidential election continues. It is clear changes need to be made to restore public confidence in our election system. Hans von Spakovsky is Senior Legal Fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He is here with some suggestions. Hans, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Hans, of course, we have the ongoing legal battle taking place over the 2020 presidential election. But looking forward, we're going to have additional federal and state elections in the coming years as well. We've seen a lot of problems arise this past year. We know what they are. Can you talk a bit for us about the underlying problems that already exist and what it is we might need to do about some of them?
Well, probably the biggest problem is the fact that voter registration lists are in such bad shape all over the country. States don't do a good job of maintaining their accuracy, and they're filled with the names of people who no longer live in the state but remain registered, folks who have died but remain registered, and unfortunately, too, folks who are registered more than once in the same state. And again, election officials don't realize that that's going on. Those kind of problems need to be fixed to ensure that, for example, people who are registered twice don't vote twice, or people who are registered in two or more states don't vote in all those states at the same time.
One of the areas where we seem to have experienced most of the problem this past election, Hans, is with these mail-in ballots. A lot of states,
right,
for various reasons, decided to expand the number of mail-in ballots they would be willing to accept. Can you talk a bit about the problems with that and the fact that there's not the chain of custody of the ballot that you have when people actually show up at a polling place?
Yeah, that's really problematic. I mean, absentee ballots are the only kind of ballots that are voted outside the supervision of election officials and outside the observation of poll watchers and observers. And that makes them vulnerable to fraud, being forged, being altered, being stolen. And it makes voters vulnerable to coercion and pressure in their homes. And what states need to do is, one, they need to minimize the use of absentee ballots. Nobody doubts that people who are sick or disabled and can't make it to the poll should be able to vote that way. But the vast majority of other voters should vote in person. And so you should have to have a valid excuse to vote through the absentee balloting process. Second, the deadline for the receipt of absentee ballots should be election day. It should not be days or weeks after the election, because that causes all kinds of problems. You have literally weeks, if not sometimes a month, 2 months, to vote by absentee ballot. There's no reason to have a deadline after election day. And very important, states need a voter ID law, not just for in-person voting, but also one that extends to absentee balloting to try to minimize the ability to submit fraudulent ballots.
We, of course, have had President Trump and many others insist that there has been fraud on a massive scale in the most recent presidential election. And I don't know if you've noticed, Hans, every time there's a media report, they always say unproven allegations of voter fraud, of election fraud. But at Heritage Foundation, you actually have a database of fraud, do you not?
We do. We have a database. We add to it all the time. In fact, we just broke the 1,300 mark. It's just 1,300 proven cases of fraud. And by proven, I mean somebody was convicted in a court of law or a court ordered a new election because of fraud. And this is not a comprehensive list. This is not all the fraud that has occurred across the country. It's just a sampling of cases as we find them and as we run across them.
In addition to fraud, we also can have mistake and right. or misconduct by people who are tabulating the ballots. Can you talk a bit about what sort of safeguards states should consider to make sure that we minimize mistakes and errors?
First of all, they need to be sure that they have people from both political parties working in polling places and elsewhere. That's the best way to stop any allegations that partisan election officials have engaged in misconduct. And they need to allow observers in every aspect of the voting and counting process. We saw numerous examples of misconduct by election officials in this past election where they locked out observers so they couldn't see what happened in counting locations and elsewhere, which is what has helped fuel the suspicion that they were engaged in misconduct. And those are just some of the most basic steps they should take.
We have seen a number of races as we speak, is even one congressional race that I believe hinges on something like 12 ballots. These incidents of fraud or just error, can you talk a little bit about how they actually can make a difference in the outcome of these races?
Well, of course they can. Just 2 years ago, we had a congressional race overturned in North Carolina because of absentee ballot fraud that was enough to change the outcome of the election. Patterson, New Jersey, just this past summer, a new election was ordered in a municipal race because, again, of absentee ballot fraud that changed the outcome. So fraud can make a difference in the election, and it's why we need to take steps to try to ensure it doesn't happen.
There's a term called ballot harvesting, and I think a lot right. of our listeners have heard of that over the last few months. Can you tell us what that term ballot harvesting means, and do all states have laws against it?
In every state, when you vote by absentee ballot, you can either mail your ballot back, you can return it yourself, or usually a member of your family can return it for you. Unfortunately, in about half of the states, they've also legalized for any other third-party stranger to show up at your door and ask to deliver your ballot. That's a very bad idea because it means that you're putting ballots into the hands of candidates, campaign staffers, party activists, and political consultants, all of whom have a stake in the outcome of the election. Like I said, about half the states allow that. The other half ban it, which is the wisest course for state legislatures to take.
We have been talking with Hans von Spakovsky, who is senior legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, that, of course, at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, tell us a little bit about Heritage and where can folks go to read more about this particular issue?
The Heritage Foundation is the largest conservative think tank in the world. We work on many different issues, including election integrity, which is very important to us. And they can go to our website, heritage.org, to look at the things we do generally. And if they're interested in this particular issue, go to heritage.org/voter fraud, and it will take you actually to our election fraud database.
Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thank you for being back with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on Washington, D.C., where all sorts of things are hopefully going to be happening. We're going to talk about that. Also, we have a bus tour coming up in Georgia where we have those two key U.S. Senate races. We're going to talk about all of that today with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
We'll start out with a policy matter. Scott, the federal budget has never been passed. It was due back the 1st of October. There was a continuing resolution that expired here a day or two ago. What did Congress do?
We saw a one-week continuing resolution that takes us to December 18th. And the reason that Congress did this was to try to work on additional coronavirus relief legislation, as well as potentially omnibus appropriations bill. And if they can accomplish both of those before Christmas, then they've obviously taken off some of the big issues for Joe Biden if he happens to be inaugurated in January.
in addition to having to pass the remainder of the fiscal year budget and also the continuing work you've referenced on a COVID-19 package, we have the National Defense Authorization Act, and this is a major piece of legislation. It looks like a battle shaping up between Congress and President Trump on this.
Yeah, we saw the president pull out the veto pen and certainly threaten the passage of the NDAA. The NDAA is a piece of legislation that authorizes the defense appropriations. So basically, Congress is working on legislation that is going to dictate a lot of the things that our military is able to spend money on. And these authorizations historically have been completed for a really, really long streak in the United States Senate. So if President Trump does ultimately find himself successful with a veto, it'll certainly break a big precedent in the Congress.
And an issue here is sort of a side issue, isn't it? This whole Section 230, and maybe you can explain what that is and why it seems to be the flashpoint.
Yeah, Section 230 for the president is a way that his message has been being stifled, and how Democrats have used technology companies and social media to create a bias in our political speech. And so Section 230 includes regulations that dictate the way that technology companies are able to filter content. And that was a big sticking point for the president. It was a big sticking point for many conservatives. The House Freedom Caucus took a position on behalf of the president's side as well. So House conservatives were certainly in support of that and in opposition to the passage of the Defense Authorization Act. But it is a big, big bipartisan bill that usually goes through at the end of the year. And right now we're seeing whether or not the president's veto will be successful.
Certainly much to keep an eye on here, a very busy end to 2020. And speaking of busy ends to 2020, we still do not know who will be in control, which party will be in control of the United States Senate, because we have those two special U.S. Senate elections upcoming January 5th in Georgia. A major effort to win those where the Republican candidates took off this past week. Tell us what's going on, Scott.
Yeah, we still got those Georgia Senate runoff races involving Kelly Loeffler and Raphael Warnock. And then you've got John Ossoff against Republican David Perdue. Club for Growth has a super PAC, Club for Growth Action, that has been working very closely with other outside groups and member groups within the coalition of the Save America Coalition. And so we've been scheduling these events throughout the state of Georgia. There will be 28 different stops over 11 days. And not only is it going to include some of these headliners, but you're going to hear from Georgia politicians that really understand what's at stake here. And we kicked off on December 11th, and we'll be going through December 21st, and then we come back out on January 3rd and 4th, the 2 days before the election, with the Save America Coalition bus tour. I hope that Georgians will come out and hear folks like Sarah Palin and see a free concert with Lee Greenwood. We'll have United States senators that are participating in this, a couple of senators-elect, including Cynthia Lummis and Tommy Tuberville. Conservative hero Jim Jordan will also be there. We're going to have Brian Fournier, who is a young conservative Trump's student for Trump organization with Turning Point Action. And then we've got another new member of Congress, Madison Cawthorn, is going to be joining us. And I think a lot of people remember Madison from his speech at the RNC. We've got a rising star with Byron Donalds coming in. He's a new member from Naples and going to be a fantastic addition to the Republican conference. Kim Klasick is also going to be coming and speaking with Georgia voters and talking about her experience. And we've got outside group leaders like Jenny Beth Martin from the Tea Party Patriots, Jessica Anderson from Heritage Action, and many other outside groups that are going to be joining us. Ted Cruz, people can expect to see from Corey Lewandowski, Lauren Boebert, and Christy Swanson, Burgess Owens, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, Jim DeMint, Tim Scott will be out there, Andrew Pollack. We've got a big, big lineup. We're continuing to add names. And we have a website, saveamericatour.com/bustour, where you can see where we're going to be, and you can request free tickets to our events.
Sounds like the peach state is the place to be for all the political action here over the next couple of weeks, taking no break really for the holiday season. One quick final point here, Scott. How important is it for Republicans in Georgia to turn out to vote? I know there's been some rogue Republicans suggesting that they should not because of fraud, but the president had a very different message. So how important is turnout to this election?
Well, I think it's the difference between socialism and capitalism in America, not just Georgia. And that's why it's important to stave off a unified government from Democrats in the House, Senate, and White House, because they will just change the rules and eliminate the filibuster, pack the courts, do all these policies, and also shift us toward a Green New Deal style economy, where the progressive left is able to just fundamentally change the way that business is conducted in America.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth, and as the weeks unfold here, heading up to that special election in Georgia, we'll continue to check in with him to find out the latest activity. Scott, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization in Washington, D.C. We've got over 500,000 members that belong to the Club for Growth. You can actually sign up for free. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is at clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Telemedicine is one way to help ease the burden on the nation's healthcare system, which has become stressed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But some laws stand in the way. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Rob Johnson from the Institute for Justice.
Anxiety and depression are on the rise this year, and I mean understandably so. Just look at everything that's gone on in 2020. But if you live in certain parts of the country, you may not be able to see your usual counselor or therapist because of some, frankly, quite silly rules that say you can cross state lines to meet with them in person, but you can't cross state lines digitally via a telephone call or a Zoom meeting, something like that. Thankfully, there are some folks that are challenging those rules, and we're going to talk to one of them today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Rob Johnson. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and he joins us on the phone now to talk about this new case that they're launching in Washington, D.C. Rob, thanks so much for taking some time and joining us.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
This is something that I think has become particularly salient because of COVID-19 and the pandemic, right? I mean, nobody is doing face-to-face meetings anymore, but that creates issues for people like your client, Elizabeth Brokamp, who's a professional counselor. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so Elizabeth is a Virginia-licensed professional counselor. She's been providing professional counseling services for over 20 years. And, you know, before the COVID pandemic, she met with her clients in person. But during the pandemic, it's easier and safer for her to provide services online using teletherapy. And actually, she's found that there are advantages to it. You know, she can meet people, you know, regardless of their schedule. It's easier to schedule. It's also easier for people like new mothers who might be hard for them to go see someone in person. So, you know, she's not only started doing teletherapy, but she wants to continue doing teletherapy. And what she's run into is before the pandemic, if there were somebody in the district, she could meet with them in person at her office in Virginia. But that same person, she cannot speak to them at their home in D.C. over the internet without violating D.C.'s licensing law. And the same would be true if she wanted to talk to someone in Maryland or any other state.
And this is an issue, obviously, in the D.C. area. There's a particular geographic issue here where you've got like two states plus the district. And, there's, you know, people go back and forth all the time. You don't even think twice about it, I guess, until you're in a situation like this. And then you're forced to think twice about it. Is this common across the rest of the country, too? Or is this like just a weird development in the D.C. metro area?
So this is an issue across the country. So, you know, it does vary from state to state, but in many states, it's unlawful for somebody out of state to talk to clients in that state without a license from the state. And as a result, you know, you might have a client who is on a business trip. If you're a counselor, it's on a business trip, or somebody who you develop a relationship with somebody and then they go off to college or they move to a different state. And then at that point, the licensing law basically is interfering with that relationship, that established relationship. And it can be very damaging for someone to have to give up an established relationship. And then, of course, you also just have people who are seeking out a new counselor, and maybe they are referred to someone in particular who they want to deal with, or they just aren't able to find a counselor in their local area. For whatever reason, they want to speak with somebody in a different state, and licensing laws are getting in the way.
I think that's a great point. You know, like the going off to college thing, for example, somebody who is being in a relationship with a counselor requires a lot of trust. That's a relationship that doesn't just happen. You don't just show up one day and accomplish something there. That's a long process. And then to have to, you know, oh, well, just because you moved across state lines. I mean, now I can talk to my family four states away over Zoom basically anytime I want to face to face. You could do that same thing if you have that sort of, you know, that same kind of trust and serious relationship with a counselor. We're talking with Rob Johnson. He is a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. He is the lead attorney on this case that's challenging these licensing laws in Washington, D.C. Rob, what is it that you're asking for here? What's the hopeful outcome for Elizabeth? Is to strike down these laws entirely, make some changes? What are you looking for?
Yeah, so really, what we're hoping to accomplish are three things. And the first is, during the pandemic, we want Elizabeth to be able to talk to her clients in the district without D.C.'s licensing laws getting in the way. And we also want to establish that she can continue to talk to people in the district after the pandemic is over. Like I said, Elizabeth has found there are advantages to teletherapy. She wants to continue doing it. And pandemic or not, this is something she has a First Amendment right to do. And then, of course, the third thing we want to do is to set a precedent. You know, we're starting in D.C., but this is a nationwide issue, and we want to make sure that Elizabeth and other counselors can talk to their clients wherever they go. And so really the principle that we want to establish is the government cannot require a license to talk to somebody about their emotions.
Yeah, and ultimately this really does come down to exactly that. It comes down to the First Amendment, because I think we get down in the weeds sometimes on these things. There's complex legal issues, and licensing laws are not things that are easily understood. But at the end of the day, like, all of that complication really just helps the government create some sort of reason for routing around what is ultimately one of the easiest things to understand, which is the First Amendment, the protection of free speech.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And one of the sort of really interesting things about this is I think D.C. recognizes that they can't enforce their law against everybody who talks. I mean, it would just be absurdly overbroad. So the way this works in practice is anybody can talk to people in D.C. about their feelings. And if Elizabeth wasn't trained and qualified as a professional counselor, she could talk to people. She could call herself a life coach, and she could provide her services that way. But it's precisely because of Elizabeth's training that D.C. says she has to be, you know, licensed as a professional counselor. It's a sort of weird topsy-turvy regime where the more qualified you are, the less right you have to talk, which just can't be consistent with the First Amendment.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. That is Rob Johnson from the Institute for Justice. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thanks for talking about the case.
And again, that is Rob Johnson from the Institute for Justice, a senior attorney with IJ. You can check out more of his work at IJ.org. You can find up there more about this case, but also about lots of other fascinating lawsuits that IJ is running all over the country. You can find more about everything else that's happening in the news at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The very heart of our constitutional system of separation of powers is what is really on the ballot in the two Georgia U.S. Senate runoff elections. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
It's myopic to think that the two Georgia special elections for the U.S. Senate that will take place on January 5th are just about Senator David Perdue versus John Ossoff and Senator Kelly Loeffler versus Reverend Raphael Warnock. They are merely the proxies for a much greater contest over what the framers of our Constitution considered its most important feature, a structure that minimized the likelihood of a concentration of power in too few hands. The solution the Founding Fathers came up with was one taken from the thought of the French theorist Montesquieu, namely separating the powers of the state into different branches of government, with the intention that each different branch, jealous of its own powers, would keep the other branches in check. Thomas Jefferson came at the same point from a slightly different angle. The executive power in our government is not the only, perhaps not even the principal object of my solicitude. The tyranny of the legislature is really the danger most to be feared, and will continue to be so for many years to come. The tyranny of the executive power will come in its turn, but at a more distant period. Some might argue that we are now living in that more distant period, but I doubt that Jefferson ever contemplated that all three branches of government would be concentrated in a single political party. Yet that's exactly what our beloved nation will face if the two Democratic Party challengers defeat the two Republican incumbents for the Senate from Georgia. Hundreds of millions of dollars, an unprecedented level of political spending, are being spent right now on those two races. Within Georgia, the main focus is on the candidates themselves. But for those of us outside of Georgia, we should not let the speeches, TV appearances, debates, and advertising of the candidates distract our attention from the greatest fear of the framers of the Constitution, concentration of power in a very few hands. It literally has the power to destroy our peculiar American experiment in citizen-driven democracy. Listen to Madison, the principal author of the Constitution, as he wrote in The Federalist, "The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny." Well, that is precisely what is likely if both Democratic Party challengers win in Georgia. A similar threat faced the nation when FDR was president, but he was stymied in his efforts to pack the Supreme Court. A President Biden, particularly if the Senate kills the filibuster, as has been intimated as an objective by several leaders in his party, will not be similarly constrained. A majority in the Senate, which would be ruled with an iron fist by Chuck Schumer as majority leader, combined with a majority in the House of Representatives, ruled by another iron fist in the person of Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and topped off by four new Biden-appointed justices of the Supreme Court to establish a liberal or progressive majority there, largely sympathetic to or even beholden to the president and Democratic Party leaders, presents a formula for tyranny worse than Madison's nightmare. If you live in Georgia, but more emphatically if you don't, try to ignore all the media chatter about Senator Perdue's empty chair or Senator Loeffler's, quote, wooden, close quote, performance in the one TV debate or on the campaign trail, and set your mind instead on the much higher issue at the heart of the Constitution, the assumption that concentration of power in a few like-minded political leaders leads to tyranny and threatens the ideals of representative government. For the sake of the nation, Republicans must win at least one of the two seats on January 5th. As Senator Orrin Hatch has said, the separation of powers, not just in theory or in textbook, but in practice, in the actual functioning of government, is the linchpin of liberty. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WYYC-AM in York, Pennsylvania, WIJD-AM in Mobile, Alabama, along with WNVY-AM in Pensacola, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.